Hello, this is Terrence McNally. At a moment when Black Lives Matter protests, the largest, most sustained mass demonstrations in U.S. history, are still taking place, and Donald Trump is sending federal secret police to incite violence in Portland, here's my 2017 conversation with Jody Evans, a tireless activist and advocate for peace, justice, and the planet. This interview was recorded as Code Pink, one of the organizations Evans founded, was celebrating its 15th birthday. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be joined today by activist, organizer, filmmaker, and author Jody Evans, co-founder of the after-school writing program 826LA, and co-founder and director of Code Pink. But first, after hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades, in 2014, I stopped recording new live interviews. And the show's continued ever since on Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. But with the election of Donald Trump, I can't resist exploring the path forward in new interviews. And before I bring Jody Evans in, let me offer you a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy and just future we need. And you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com to get these websites and more information. Indivisibleguide.com, indivisibleguide, one word, .com. That's probably the largest organization that's arisen since the election. I think there are over 5,000 chapters around the country. OurRevolution.com, Our Revolution, one word. That's the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, a longtime online activist, now working more closely with grassroots movements on the ground. Same is true for the CourageCampaign.org, CourageCampaign, one word, .org. Sort of similar to MoveOn, but in California. And then two kind of specifically for how to rattle the cages of your representatives, fivecalls.org. That's the number five and the word calls.org, which will tell you what calls are most relevant and timely for you to make these days. And then Town Hall Project, one word, Town Hall Project, which tells you when your representatives might be coming into town holding town halls so you can go there and hold their feet to the fire. I've known today's guest for over 20 years. And throughout that time, Jody Evans has been a tireless activist, advocate, and communicator for peace, justice, and the planet. And when I noticed that Code Pink, one of the organizations she co-founded, had just turned 15, I thought it was a good time to catch up with Jody. Jody's co-founder, as I said, of the after-school writing program 826LA, that's Dave Eggers' organization, as well as co-founder and director of Code Pink. She was director of administration in California Governor Jerry Brown's first administration. She managed Brown's 92 presidential campaign. She's a producer of several documentaries, including Stripped and Teased, Tales from Las Vegas Women, The People Speak, based on Howard Zinn's A People's History of the U.S., and the Oscar-nominated The Square on the Arab Spring Uprising in Egypt. And she's co-editor of two books, Twilight of Empire, Responses to Occupation, and Stop the Next War Now, Effective Responses to Violence and Terrorism. Welcome again, Jody Evans, to Freeform.
Thanks, Terrence. So nice to be with you.
Yeah. Now, as you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. And I mentioned a few highlights, but could you share with us your own sense of your path to the work you do today, your early background, perhaps, your entry into activism, and kind of the evolution of your work over the years. And I'll cut in, but you can take a bit of time with this and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. How did Jody Evans become Jody Evans?
Oh, that remains a mystery, but I would say one of my first moments was I was a maid in 1970 at one of the hotels, big hotels in Las Vegas, where I was born and raised. And we were organized to march for a living wage. And we won, and Jane Fonda came and marched with us that August down the strip. And the maids still get a living wage to this day. And my first documentary was about that. about the power of these women in the labor movement in Las Vegas. But I think it was then that I saw I could spend the rest of my life taking on the man, because it was doing so much harm. It was the beginning of the feminist movement arising in the U.S., and clearly the patriarchy, capitalism, it was the beginning of Earth Day. I mean, so much was arising in 1970 to what we were living inside of and we were becoming aware of. So I think that was my kicking off moment. I then fought for 18-year-olds to get a right to vote, because my friends who had just left high school were getting killed in Vietnam, and then came to Los Angeles to work on the McGovern campaign.
And by the way, I also came to Los Angeles to work on the McGovern campaign. So
awesome.
we go back further than we do.
There were so many people in those rooms in L.A. in the early days, and Jerry Brown was the state chair of the McGovern campaign, and Max Pilevsky, who I later married, was his major donor. So that few months in the McGovern campaign were pivotal to the rest of my life. I say to my son, who was very active in Obama's campaign, and after Obama won and then it kind of turned sour, I realized that McGovern losing was probably one of the best things that happened to us, because so many of us from that campaign, we lived out of those ideals, and we turned them into reality with our lives. And, you know, I watched for Matthew that it just became depressing, that everything that was promised with that campaign got watered down and a lot wasn't accomplished. And for him, that, you know, we were fighting for health care but not universal health care didn't make sense, or that Obama was using drones more than Bush, it was heartbreaking to see that what you thought was a shining light got tarnished. So after McGovern campaign, Jerry reached out to me, and I started working on his, in 1973, I started working on his governor's race. And funny enough, I just had dinner with Jerry and a bunch of us in D.C., including Bill Press, this Sunday.
All of whom met back in those early days?
Yeah, Bill Press, Lucy Yankovic. We were all kind of sitting around the same table we had sat around for 45 years. by the way, to anyone listening, Jerry's willing to be recruited to run for president. He looks out in just desperation and sadness, and is excited about what he's doing in September to bring countries together to make major pledges for the planet. So he's very, as always, dedicated to the planet, even though he continues to let fracking happen in California. His answer to that is, as long as Californians are using oil, we can't say not in our backyards.
Let me stay with Jerry just for a second, because I was going to ask you about him anyway. So let me pick it up at this moment, which is that, and just again, as I said, you were director of administration in the first administration. Then as you ran the 92 campaign. Brown is a phenomenon, the longest serving governor, and he's both the sixth youngest and the oldest California governor in history. Can you talk a little bit about your work with Jerry and sort of your parallel, if you will, evolutions?
Wow. That's 45 years of my life. I would say that, you know, when starting in 1973, Jerry was those ideals that came out of the McGovern campaign. And even the race was about the possibility of, you know, a new future. And those 8 years as governor were amazing, nothing short of amazing. To walk in after a Reagan governorship into a 36-year-old governor, and all of us were younger than he was. So just kind of imagine. And to be able to really anything is possible. And I worked on a lot of appointments. I worked on a lot of bills, and they were pivotal. I mean, you know, legalizing acupuncture, getting more than 50% of women as appointees, including in his cabinet. Mario Robledo was the Secretary of Health, and he had been part of the Poor People's Campaign, camping out outside the White House in 1968 with Martin Luther King. I mean, the people that held the secretary positions were radicals. They were doing radical things, and Jerry was fearless in appointing them, including Rose Byrd, Chief Justice, to the Supreme Court. I mean, I ask him about that now, and he's just sad that maybe he reached too far, which meant that the right got to take over the Supreme Court because Rose was too far of a reach. But I think what happens is his reaching far allowed others to reach far, and, you know, always those first reaches get pushed back on. But if we don't reach that far, we don't break through and allow more to happen. So I would say he was a wedge that just pushed forward through, you know, everything.
Let me reflect, which is that it's interesting to hear him say that perhaps he pushed too far, because I'm with you that he moved the horizon of what was possible and what you could consider, and of course there was reaction. But I'll tell you, just because if we look at where California is today, you know, it's in some sense the fruition of having set the mark so far then. And let me tell you an experience that I had, which was very soon after the election. The California Endowment held a big meeting of nonprofits and advocacy organizations and so on. And this is right after the election, and the mood was really kind of dark. And this one Latina woman, probably about 30, got up and said, "You know what? When I woke up on November 9th, I tried to remember when had I felt that bad." And she said, "It was back in 94 when Prop 87 had passed." And she said, "At that point, it looked like the darkest thing in the world. The Republicans were running the state, you know, all of this." And she said, "And to look where we've come to now, you know, sort of let's remember that we can move forward from here." And so I think, I mean, the fact that he sowed those seeds that early, but if you look at California now, I sort of feel like California, with its flaws, with its imperfections, as you say, fracking and poverty and so on, it still is, to my sense, a 21st century state in a country that's sort of holding back and holding on to the past.
I mean, that was certainly my experience. He really, I mean, you know, living inside of it, it was, you were changing not just the United States, but the world. The world was in relationship to what he was leading in California. I know that so many, he talks, I say, "So what, you know, what make politicians behave so badly?" And he says, "Fear." And so I, you know, what was happening then was he was fearless.
Mm-hmm.
He had a disdain for politicians. He was going to do it differently, and he did. Now, I had an experience in the office. I knew how much Jerry loved Cesar Chavez. We were all working on the farm labor bill, and it came time to act, and he backed down because the farmers threatened him. And so I went with Cesar to Delano, and we marched from Delano up to the governor's office, and I sat outside the governor's office with the farm workers. And it was in that moment I said, for the rest of my life, I'm going to sit outside of power, because power is stupid, and it's not about the people. It's just about power itself. And power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely is very real. And you do get afraid once you have power. You get afraid that you're going to lose it. I watch it with people with money. They get afraid they're going to lose it. And it's one of the driving forces of, you know, just what's wrong in our world. And so, yeah, I mean, I got to learn a lot about power, and it served me in trying to shift it and knowing where to target. But it also changed me that I never wanted to be inside again.
Mm-hmm. And, let me just share one other thing that comes up as you were saying that. I happened to spend the night last night in a college kid's room. I was staying with some friends, And on his door, he had, "When the power of love overcomes the love of power, we will finally achieve peace." Jimi Hendrix.
Yep. And we're, you know, and being the hippie that I am, we've really come back to that time. I have to say, you know, everybody got a little lost, and I think we were onto something then. But, and, you know, our understandings of the perils of capitalism, but it's back, and it's back. People are really getting, and, you know, Trump helping. Trump's one of the great organizers for the left on the planet.
Well, yes. I mean, if we think of what birthed the first 60s, you know, with the Vietnam War and so on, it takes it for more than a few to become activated, it seems to take a crisis.
And a recognition of what you live inside of. You know, we use the story about the frog in the water.
Yep.
But the frog, you know, here's the chance for the frogs to jump out of the water because it's kind of a wake up call and the muscles are twitching again. So jump out, you know. And a few years back at Code Pink, you know, it's just like you're talking about 15 years. Well, we started not an organization, but we started a vigil outside the White House to stop the war on Iraq, which was crazy and driven by lies. And Bush was frightening the American people with the terror code alerts of red, orange, and yellow, and we said Code Pink for Peace. And beyond our wildest imaginations, could a government go to war on a country that they had already destroyed with sanctions? Like, I mean, it was just unthinkable. We're here 15 years later, and now we're in 8 wars, and $1.4 trillion worth of weapons sold a year, and 65% of our tax money going to war. And it was, you know, maybe 4 years ago that I looked at global climate change, global inequality, and all that, the weapon sales. In history, the only answer has been fascism, because it just gets out of control, and then people are willing to submit to fascism to get things back into control. And I decided, well, the answer for those of us that are part of Code Pink and activists is to grow local peace economies, that no matter what, global climate change, which at our Code Pink summit to launch our new campaign this weekend, VJ Prashad called it capitalist planetary destruction. He said, don't call it global climate change. The climate didn't decide to be windier.
So what
capitalism drove it to that. But
what was the term again?
Capitalist planetary destruction.
Yeah.
Let's call it really what it is.
Yes.
So, you know, no matter what we're going to be at the effects at, because we will be, because it's already happened. It's not happening in the future. It has already happened. We have, you know, destroyed the fabric of society. We have violated the planet. We have created an inequality that is going to be, that is already so horrific to so many around the globe, that we, you know, the war economy alienates us from ourselves and each other. We're human beings. Connection is our way of being. But capitalism, or the war economy, I call it, because I call it the war economy because I realize we're not going to end war until we end the war economy, because war is serving the war economy very well. And the war economy has become our culture, which is frightening. But if you start to look at it and you start to practice, like, how do I divest from the war economy, you start to recognize, yes, we have been acculturated to a war economy. We are living inside of it. It's the water we breathe. And there's a peace economy. It exists. It's the giving, sharing, caring, thriving, relational, resilient economy without which none of us would be alive. But we've devalued it. We've devalued the feminine. We've devalued caring. We've devalued education and caring for each other. And, you know, what did it, none of us would be here without the peace economy, which is the sharing, giving, which is our parents, our community, and all the ways we give to each other every day. But instead, we, like, live it with each other in a transactional way, which isn't the way we need to live with each other. So, like, could be, you know, during the Obama administration, you said, well, nobody's listening to us as we are trying to end war and trying to end the money for war. Why don't we take all this energy and build locally and be responsive to our communities, be responsive to those who are at the effects of the war economy in the worst ways work on a just transition that involves them, you know, that doesn't involve, you know, let's not take care of middle-class white people, but let's go to where the poor and the planet and those that are really suffering at the effect of this culture that we are a part of. We're all a part of. And we're all a part of war because we pay 65% of our tax dollars to fund it.
Yeah.
And our summit this weekend was...
So tell me about... Let's come back to that. Let's go back to the birth of Code Pink, okay? In other words, you what you said so far, but I want to get just a little more of the feeling and the picture of that time. What you said was it didn't start out as an organization or a movement. It started out as a vigil. Now, this is in the lead up to the Iraq War. The lies are out there. The mood is happening, and you had an organization, as I recall, Unreasonable Women for the Earth, right? And Code Pink's somehow birthed from that. And tell us just about that birth.
Well, we were at Bioneers, would have been 16 years ago,
right.
Just this last weekend.
I was there this past weekend. So let me tell for anyone who doesn't know, although Bioneers has been on this show many times, Bioneers is a conference that's now in its 28th year that basically says we're all related, we're all biology, we're all et cetera. And it brings together every year certainly a community of people who see the world differently. So a bunch of you were at Bioneers.
And Diane Wilson, who was one of the speakers that year,
yep.
And who is an unreasonable woman. She's a shrimper, and she sunk her boat on top of Alcoa to stop them from dumping toxic waste into the Gulf, the Texas Gulf.
Around Houston, right? Around Houston,
yeah.
Texas. Yeah.
And so she had said, you know, a reasonable woman conforms to the world, an unreasonable woman has the world, you know, respond to them. May we all be unreasonable women. And so Nina and I did a retreat of unreasonable women, and Medea was there, and Caroline Casey was there, who literally is the person who called Code Pink. It was Code Hot Pink when she called it, but we, the day we started Code Pink, we looked up to get the website, and it was a porn site, so we had to calm it down.
So Code Hot Pink went, but Code Pink stayed.
Yeah. So, you know, we had gotten together, and really our work had been about the planet. You know, our gathering had been, we were going to go naked at the Texas Gulf and say, you know, we were decent and what they were doing was indecent. And as we were planning, we started hearing about the Bush administration and this wacky idea to bomb an innocent country. So Medea and myself, Diane, Starhawk, we kind of met at a girlfriend's house in D.C. and said, you know, what are we going to do? And I want to say that first morning when Bush is announcing this outside the Rose Garden, it was literally just eight women. We were a really small group, and we went outside the White House and said, you know, Diane Wilson climbed up on the White House fence and said the world does not want this war and didn't come down, and the media came running from the Rose Garden to cover it. And as soon as they find out she wasn't a terrorist but an anti-war activist, it went off the news. We disrupted that day. We got Nancy Pelosi to come out and say she would vote against the war, which was breaking with the leadership. At the time, she was the whip. We said, come join us. Let's stand outside the White House until we get them to stop. And we stood out there for many months, and then we decided to go to Iraq and went for 10 days to Iraq, and were there when Colin Powell lied about the weapons of mass destruction. And
in his speech at the UN?
In his speech to the UN.
Yeah.
We were We were in the information center in Baghdad watching it with a global community, all of whom knew it was a lie. Gail Murphy, who was there with us, climbed up on the CNN box, pushed Nick Robertson, who was on the box, off and said, the world does not want this war, and they cut it out. I mean, you know, we've been trying to disrupt this story. We're constantly disrupting Congress. We disrupted Panetta yesterday at a think tank where he was talking, where we were bringing up the weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, and the poor woman who was moderating, she didn't know what to do, but he was quite calm, and after we left, we'd been dragged out, he said, welcome to a congressional hearing, that, you know, Code Pink disrupting congressional hearings is as much as a senator being in, or a congressional member being in one, is the norm.
Yeah.
We have not stopped saying this is madness since we started 15 years ago.
Very good. Very good. So that's Code Pink. And let me ask you this. When you folks said, let's do a vigil outside the White House, and that first vigil lasted several months, as I recall, if I had asked you that day, Jody, you and Medea and Diane and so on, where does this organization go? How long do you last? What do you think you thought then? And how does it feel that the battles are, right now it's about Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and as well as Afghanistan and Iraq and several,
and North Korea.
North Korea and several countries in Africa.
Right.
Just a little bit of
start an organization. We just stood outside the White House and asked people to join us.
Yeah.
And we didn't think we had an we were just women saying no. It was years later where, you know, I can tell you constantly is, well, we're going to stop this war. We're going to stop this madness. We're going to, you know, stop the occupation. We're going to stop the money being wasted on war. We're going to stop, I think it was, 3 years later before I had to surrender and go, oh, my God, it's an organization, which is not really what we had planned to do with our lives. So, and in that way, you know, like the 15 years, it's a responsibility. I believe we have not been able to let go of because it just gets worse.
Right.
And so many people are suffering. And, you know, you look at there's a New York Times piece this week on Boko Haram and the women that were strapped up. And we know that women lead to peace. We know that the voice of women is missing. We know that, we have the Congress is not being responsible about not letting a president take us to war over and over again. We look out and think, what does it look like if we had a military coup? Have we not really just had one? And it's just silent that... So presidents continue to be able to spend our tax dollars on war that no one that represents us has agreed to.
That's right. And in other words, they justify almost everything still to one vote back prior to the Iraq war, linked to the attack on 9/11.
And that had nothing to do with anybody that was involved with 9/11.
Oh, of course.
9/11 people were from Saudi Arabia.
Yep.
And we're talking about Afghanistan and Iraq that had nothing to do with it. And now, and then we keep starting wars and then occupying with our weapons all these countries, including our weapons are occupying Palestine. It's really the weapons companies that we're serving, and people are making a profit, and that's our new campaign to stop all these companies, people, our government, our churches, our schools, our pensions funds from making a killing on killing and trying to let everyone know that we're all responsible here. You know, we keep trying to stop it, and what we continue to unveil is the people who are accountable here are the people, and we need to find different ways for more people to get engaged. I mean, look, the Women's March did not have an anti-war message and its platform. It's like we've all gone numb to what is one of the most important issues. It destroys the planet. It's around oil. These wars are around oil and assets. They're for the government. They're for corporations. They do not make anyone safer. It's all a lie, but they continue to happen.
And as you point out, I hadn't even realized that about the Women's March, that that these two wars have been going on for so long, and because there's no draft, affect only certain sectors of society in terms of who goes, who's in danger, who gets killed, who gets traumatized, but we all pay for it, and we all, as you point out, have grown numb to the fact that it's even going on in our name, and that it every dollar, as Eisenhower said as far back as 1950, 1960, I guess, but every dollar that goes to war doesn't go to schools, doesn't go to communities,
doesn't go to health care, doesn't go to, like, creating a new grid so that we can get off the oil that is we're addicted to that's actually feeding the war. It's
so what?
Bad.
So what? So you said that this past weekend you had the kickoff of
Our new campaign,
right.
Which was yet again we're with a Congress and a president that are literally Teflon. So we can, you know, do all the outreach we want and to our members of Congress, but it's not making a difference. So I was trying to find out, well, where could I make a difference? And I've been on the board of Reinforced Action Network for 20 years, and I've watched our successes going after corporations. And it seemed like time to, as another wake-up call, for all of us to understand how our lives are benefiting from making a killing on killing, that the weapons companies are owned by all of us. They're in pension funds, they're in university funds, they're owned by our cities and our states and our counties. And it's time to wake people up and to see how we are all in collusion with war.
Yeah, and I assume most people probably know this, but I don't think there has been a year since I've been an adult that the U.S. was not the greatest arms dealer in the world. So we're not even talking about the wars we're engaged in. We also supply the arms, and very often to both sides.
Oh, to dictatorships. I think we're supplying weapons to every dictatorship, just
yeah.
FYI.
And obviously when the Iraq troops are fighting the Kurdish troops, they're probably both using our weapons.
Well, let me tell you about one of the worst things that's happening right now, and it's something everyone can act on right now, and that's Yemen. We are supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons that have created already a humanitarian crisis that's really unfathomable. And, you know, the UN envoy literally just weeps every time he has to talk about it because it's so horrific. There are now 2 million kids in Yemen that are at the edge of life because there's a famine and the constant bombing with U.S. weapons of the port of Haditha makes it so no humanitarian aid can get inside, food can't get inside, and no humanitarian support can get inside. And it's horrific. And right now, two amazing members of Congress, Congressman Rokana and Congressman Pocan, have found a place in the Congressional War Act that says if a member of Congress sees that the U.S. is illegally at war, they have the power to bring it to the floor of the House and ask for an immediate vote. So they have now three Republicans. They have about 20 Democrats. They have a lot of support, bipartisan support from attorneys, you know, on the bill, legal professionals, people all over the world. And the vote's going to happen in a few weeks, so everybody just needs to call any congressperson they feel like. And you can go to codepink.org/res81, R-E-S-81. You can send it to your member of Congress. Keep on calling and dialing. This is so important because literally you can stop war. And this isn't confusing. I feel like people don't get engaged in war because it overwhelms them and they get confused. This is not confusing. This says you have to stop giving weapons and supporting the war of Saudi Arabia on Yemen. It's clear. It is clear. It is causing a humanitarian crisis. Republicans are getting it. You can engage right now and stop a war and stop 2 million kids in Yemen from dying.
Okay, so codepink.org/RES81.
Correct.
Okay. We'll give that out again at the end. But so this, what you're saying is the dirty wars we're engaged in span the globe, but here is one where there is where there can be some focus and some action that can actually bring this to a vote and get people to finally, I mean, even recognize that we're at war in Yemen.
And I want to just, you know, note that these are members of Congress that are leading on this, which is quite heartening, that their stomachs are finally turning and that they can't participate in this anymore. And that you see some of the leadership right now, like that used to happen in the anti-war movement, really happening out of members of Congress. That should tell you how bad it is.
Yeah, that's exciting. Let me tell people that this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with activist, organizer, filmmaker, and author Jody Evans, co-founder and director of Code Pink. And you can learn more at codepink.org, Code Pink, one word. And then, as we just talked about, you can take action by going to codepink.org/RES81 and voice your support with your representatives for the resolution to stop our involvement in arming Saudi Arabia to kill folks in Yemen. For this week's conversation and many others, you can go to my website, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com to the same website. And if you email me at TEMcNally@mac.com, I'll send you a weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some articles to bring you up to speed. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2017 conversation with Jody Evans, a tireless activist and advocate for peace, justice, and the planet. This interview was recorded as Code Pink, one of the organizations Evans founded, was celebrating its 15th birthday. The local peace economy piece, what is that? And I understand sort of where your eye turns to that, which is you look at the federal government and you say a couple of things. This is from my perspective. One, the federal government, because the senators and representatives are so overwhelmingly picked by rural counties due to gerrymandering, and the president in this case and in the case of George Bush is elected by the Electoral College despite losing, in this case, the popular election by 3 million votes. The federal government is in the hands of lobbyists and money. And the action, it seems to me, is on city level, regional level, state level, and local level. So talk about your local peace economy initiative.
Well, I mean, basically, we don't live in a democracy, is what you just said. So when we keep getting hooked by the fact that we think we live in a democracy, we get distracted from where we can actually make change. And that was one of the things that really led us to this, is that we're not paying attention to what's happening. And when you go local, you start to really get clear about what's happening. But when you start to try to fix what's local, it starts to inform you to the bigger patterns that are global. And the peace economy isn't about just getting engaged locally. It's about understanding that there is an economy that you are part of that is destructive, and that you live inside of that, and you're responsible for your behavior inside of that, and to recognize all the ways you've become transactional. And it's hard to do because it's so close, it's so immediate, and it's so the water we swim in.
Right, right.
But if you get into a community and you start to ask questions and share, it's almost magical how quickly you get to recognize these patterns, because deeply we are human. And yet, to survive, we're forced to behave in ways that aren't nourishing to life and the planet and connection. So the growing local peace economy is really a practice. It's the practice, really, of being human again, of being connected, of not letting the story that there's scarcity, or that it's a dog-eat-dog world and it's like, I got to get mine, or that everything you do comes out of a transactional relationship. And so the first thing is getting in a community where you're going to practice that together, where you're going to look at your behavior, where you're going to explore different ideas, and where you're going to get engaged with those that have been paying the greatest cost of this war economy. And so some examples in Los Angeles are, after the attacks in Riverside, we came together as our local peace economy and said, so what do you do about Islamophobia? Because it's dealing with these notions that take our heart away and put us into fear, but that we then don't in some way become relational with. So somebody came, like, we went around the room, and by the time we were done crafting, it was to do pop-up for peace meals. People all over the country picked them up, and their gatherings with the Muslim community, with your community, and learning, talking about, discussing, what does this look like? For me, it's very reminiscent of, you know, what is it to be a feminist? What is it to be a woman in this world? You know, what is it to be in a world that's connected, not separated, divided, and full of hate? Another came out of, what do you do in my neighborhood about 1,500 homeless kids from 14 to 24? Well, first you start feeding them out of your car. Then you get people to help with help them with food. And then you find a church that'll give you a place where you can feed them once a week and distribute condoms, and where, you know, Venice Family Clinic can come in and help on health care. And then one of the people helping with therapy ends up to be married to the Snapchat person who ends up to buy a building, who ends up that there's like all these homeless kids are now being loved. And it's at the core of the local peace economy is love. And in a world full of hate, to practice love, to literally go in and practice love, is the healing. And, you know, I care that everybody cares about the Syrian war and the Yemen war and the Iraq war and the Afghan war, but they're caring isn't doing anything. When you start to change, to get out of the zombiness that war causes and be directly connected to those at the effects of the war economy, you start to heal. You start to be connected. So no matter what's going to happen, like a hurricane, an earthquake, a disaster, anything, you're connected. You're in trust. You're not out of trust. You remember what it is to be generous, and that there is a field of generosity and caring that is always available to you. So you don't move out of alienation and scarcity. You move out of connection and generosity. And so it becomes a practice that you do together. It's its own form of church, but it's a growing a local peace economy. What do we do together as a community? How do we learn from each other? How do we, like, tap on each other's shoulder and say, wow, that's super transactional, you know, because our cell phones and our computers make us so transactional. I mean, I watched that myself. Like, what is it to pick up the phone and call somebody anymore or to hear somebody's story and not be in three words? Or what's at the core of your heart? Mm-hmm. And I've watched these across the country be so nourishing and literally change people's life. And one thing I can promise, and it makes you happier. I mean, I would say that the war economy, one of its first result is unhappiness, alienation. And starting to grow your local peace economy first thing it does is bring you to joy because you remember you're connected and you're operating out of love.
Yeah.
And as someone who's had a lot of loss in her life, I learned early in grief the way you heal is to love someone else. And so it's really an opportunity to love and to learn together and to not come at anything like you know the answer, that we none of us know the answers, but to come with a curious heart and mind. And we live in another, the other thing about the war economy is it's all about answers. I mean, I went to Iraq, and I think one of the things that was so nourishing was that all the conversations were curious.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was curious in what they wanted to learn, but nobody felt like they knew the truth. We live in such a distorted reality in the United States. We, you know, living in the empire is something we all have to remember we do, and it's distorting and it's horrible. I mean, if you're, you know, we're against empires, but we live in one,
mm-hmm.
and it affects our behavior, and being in community together helps us wake up and understand our privilege against the rest of the world. It helps us understand the cost the world pays for our behaviors and our privileges.
Let me ask you said that there are that these local peace economies are popping up all over the country. Is there a central place where people can kind of look for how to and lessons learned or anything like that?
Yes, at the Code Pink website, codepink.org. And it's right off our homepage. But, you know, I'm going to give you my email because I love helping everyone from the beginning. It's one of my favorite things because then I get to hear how much joy it is and share their stories. We also have a place on alternet.org/LPE, Local Peace Economy, where we share stories. And so I'm Jody at codepink.org.
And that's Jody, J-O-D-I-E. At codepink.org. So that is Jody Evans' email address. If you are interested in founding, beginning a local peace economy, finding a local peace economy that's already happening, or just letting her know what's happening with your local peace economy, get in touch with Jody, J-O-D-I-E at codepink.org. So codepink.org, and on the homepage you'll see local peace economy or LPE.
Growing a local peace economy.
Growing a local peace economy, you tell the stories of what's going on at alternet.org/LPE.
Because each local peace economy is going to be relational to where it's being created. And what growing your local peace economy does is aliven your own creativity, that there are no right ways or right answers. There's only how do you relate to your community and what does it need? So a big part of it is just breaking our habits of thinking that we don't know what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
and that we don't know the right answers for our own community.
But it's interesting. It's interesting you said it's breaking out of thinking that we don't know the right answers for our own community at the same time as we don't assume we do know the answers, right? It's that we are more empowered and we have more ability than we think, but it doesn't come from saying I've got the answer. It comes from saying it comes from inquiry with your neighbors, with your fellow citizens, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And to stay in the inquiry, you
yes.
know, that we don't come to an end. And I think there's so much of the way we behave that we think, okay, I'm done. I figured it out. We're human living organisms where everything is constantly in change, and we need to remain, especially now as change happens at such a pace, we need to remain active and breathing, relational with that change.
Mm-hmm. Let me say one thing that I've been looking at since Trump's election, and Naomi Klein titled her most recent book, No Is Not Enough, right? And it's been my contention, which is what she's saying in that thing, that since the election, we have the possibility actually here, and this is something you hinted to at the start, of transforming this moment, of it is so bad that now people recognize it and we can mobilize people to go way beyond resisting Trump to finally actually saying, wait a minute, this happens because we haven't achieved the society that we need. We haven't been serious enough about pursuing the goals of you know, reversing climate change, achieving economic and social justice, and this restoration of community that we all need to feed ourselves. Do you have the sense, as I do, that in fact there's the possibility that we will look back in years and say this is when the turnaround began?
Well, there's the possibility, but there's not the probability. I mean, that's the thing we have to wake up to. It's a little bit of how we got in here is we outsource our citizenship as who we are as a global citizen. And we think other people have the answers and we could just elect them and then they'll solve all the problems. And I think the one thing that Trump has helped us see is that we're all in this together and we can't outsource that somebody else is going to do it, and that we have to hold everybody accountable and responsible that takes on responsibility and power instead of closing our eyes and just hoping it's going to happen. And, you know, there's one of the things I've noticed a lot lately, especially as in the United States, is that we move into innocence. Like, I'm innocent. I'm not responsible. I don't want to know about that because then I have to act. And that level of, like, I'm not responsible doesn't work anymore. So it's really going to be our choice. But there's the possibility, but not the probability, given the way we've behaved. It's going to take a change in the way we behave. And that's what we're trying to create the possibility for with growing a local peace economy, that it does change your behavior. And behavior change takes practice, and it doesn't take wishing. We can't wish behavior change. And we know, we all know that from having to change our behaviors around many things.
Sure.
But we keep thinking we can just say it and wish it and it will happen, but it won't.
Yeah.
And so I would say that's one of the most important features of growing a local peace economy, is that you come into a community where you agree to practice behavioral change, and it happens. I mean, I'm working with Reverend Barber on the Poor People's Campaign, and we're always comparing notes, and he says that growing a local peace economy is exactly what Moral Mondays was, and it took like 6 months, but once you hit it, it's like exponential. And because it is feeding life, because it is out of life, and the exponentiality and how you meet each other and what the connections are profound and beautiful. And I feel like after all these months, I can say that and say it with confidence that we're just not practicing it enough, and too many of us are stuck and depressed, and this is a way out of that into the creation of, yes, the thing we look back at and say, we turned the corner.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask you a couple of questions, kind of pull back a little bit and ask you a couple of questions really for people. I mean, to my mind, since I've known you, you have always been an activist. You have always been kind of pulled and called by it and you know, taking action, risking things and so on. How do you take care of yourself and avoid burnout when the work for peace and justice seems so endless?
Well, I guess I would say that I work with amazing people that inspire me every day. And, you know, Code Pink, it's all about laughing and dancing and singing. And part of Code Pink is that, you know, it's really important for us to be disarming and not arming. So we're always having to laugh and figure out how we enter the moment with the most spontaneity and surprise, which keeps us, I think, more joyful. But also, I cry a lot. I feel deeply. I think sometimes we get exhausted because we think we have to will through it. And I think that, you know, at Code Pink, we do a lot of crying and a lot of feeling and a lot of connecting and a lot of loving, and that keeps us going. And we don't let ourselves rush past a moment of grief without really taking the time to feel it and think about it and find ways to be in relationship with it. I would say in the growing of a local peace economy, I've really watched, to great sadness, too many people who've shut down around what's happening. And I know that we can only address it with open hearts
And that means there's a lot of crying.
Mm-hmm.
And how did our,
let me also
at our launch this weekend of the Divest from the War Machine campaign, a lot of crying. And you can see that it's that was live streamed on the Real News, and it's available there. I would encourage people to watch it. It's very inspiring. Lots of great information. Lots of great inspiration too.
Where do we find that?
At the Real News.
And what would they look for? Divestment?
Divest from the War Machine. TheRealNews.com.
Okay, great. Thanks. Let me ask you one other thing. You started out, as you said, in 1970 as a very young woman getting involved in a labor action with older folks. And now you are a mentor to young people. What do you see in today's young people?
Oh, my God, so much hope and so much fierce, smart. I mean, I think of myself at their age, and we had a lot of learning to do. We were pretty innocent. And the fierceness and the take-no-prisoners, you know, willingness to speak out and to not compromise, to hold power accountable. You know, I think to be living in a country where people really understand the cost of capitalism, and it's vast, where we've been sleepwalking through that for far too long and thinking we can make a good capitalism, and now we've got enough, I think, of a community that sees, no, that isn't going to happen, and the costs are profound, and there have been too many asleep. And, you know, in that sense of taking control and knowing that you're responsible as a citizen, I would say that that's one of the things this young generation gets. They're, like, not giving it back over to anybody because it's failed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I've talked to you before about this notion that in some sense we're in a 60s 2.0 moment where the young people hold many of the same values, but they've got things we didn't have. They've got technologies. They've got generations that support them. And they've got back, as you know, in the 60s, it was male-dominated. The action was male-dominated. And now when I look at the movements for change and the movements for justice, the new voices of women, of blacks, of Latinas, of immigrants and so on, is just a whole bunch of genius and power that wasn't tapped in the 60s.
Right, and I think it was repressed. So when you repress voices, you repress the possibility for change, and I think that's been understood by some and appreciated by others. So, yes, it's nice to have close to everyone at the table. I'm sure there's a lot of voices we're still leaving out and we're constantly learning, but that's what they have, is that they're not going to back down because they've been let down. And I stand at the ready to serve constantly.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're going to bring it to a close, Jody. The website, and I'm going to give you all the different things we mentioned. The primary website for Code Pink is codepink.org. But while you're there, you can go to codepink.org/RES81 and take action with your representative on the resolution to end our complicity with the war in Yemen. You can email Jody herself, jody@codepink.org, that's J-O-D-I-E, to actually interact with her about starting or being part of a local peace economy. You can go to alternet.org, that's alternet.org/LPE, to learn stories of local peace economies in action. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. And if you want to see my weekly email announcements or talk to me about any of this, email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. And thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, And most of all, to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you.
Hi, it's radio veteran Nicole Sandler. Sadly, the radio we all grew up listening to and the industry in which I worked for 40 years has been decimated.
I turned up the radio. I can't hear it.
Thanks to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, a handful of giant corporations control what you hear on the so-called public airwaves all across the nation.
So you had better do what you were told.
But times have changed.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio.
It's the 21st century, and at Progressive Voices, we're reclaiming our time. Progressive Voices, now powered by TuneIn, speaking truth to power 24/7 on the Progressive Voices Network.